This is Aiden Lohr with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Jason Wilson, who's the new Director of Ops for Hagland Aviation, doing business as Raven Connect, and Greg Tanner, who's in charge of their operations center. There's been a lot of press recently that touched on some changes that have gone on here at Hagland. I've had a lot of questions, and I know these guys. I've worked with this company since 95, and I didn't buy into a lot of the press I was reading, but I wanted to get the word from Jason himself as to what changes Raven Connect may be doing to address some of the issues that the press was bringing up. And that was related to a series of incidences over the last year and a half, and that did result in a fatal accident in December, which is always a sad event. And some of the changes they've implemented since then. So we're out in the out in Palmer, Alaska, where they've got their new operations center, and that's sort of probably the marquee change that they've made. So Jason, you're the new DO, so you took over kind of and started implementing these changes. What are the key factors that you've changed to your operation from what you might have done in the past?
Well, we've enhanced our operational patrol processes. We've built more accountability and reliability into our operational patrol processes and procedures. And we've developed a center here that's very progressive for the state of Alaska. It's something that's never been seen here. It's a big support for the operations out there. It's a big, big company oversight process now, so we've got a lot of accountability in our systems, and we've standardized our entire operation through this center.
Okay, and it's basically a centralized dispatch system.
Yes, as opposed to having flight followers or flight coordinators at each base who have, you know, a variety of different tasks that are going on at any given time. These guys are dedicated just to releasing flights and checking the pertinent information for each flight prior to departure. So there's not distracted by customers or passengers. Freight loads.
The finances.
So it's just strictly based on operations and safety.
Cool. And it's and yesterday morning I did a tour of the station, and it's two rooms are set up with computers where the ops agents can check the weather. They can check the flights that are actually dispatched. They can actually pull up approach plates using ForeFlight, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And so they're working with the pilots. So when a ForePilot can dispatch a flight, they call back here and have a discussion with the ops agent and go over the parameters of the flight. And this is separate from the financial side of the flight, whether the flight's going to make money. It's all about the safety of the flight and how to do it within compliance and safely.
Yeah, we also, another change we made is implementing a risk assessment. We started that September last year, and it's evolved into something that's a practical, useful tool for the pilots. It allows us to start tracking data and information on higher risk operations that we have in Western Alaska. It allows us to identify those risks and then mitigate them properly. So we can, you know, certain times of year, we may change our schedules to accommodate what's occurring out there, or runway conditions, whatever pops up.
Let's talk about the risk assessment forms. I know you know that my opinion on risk assessment forms has always been that they've been out here for a number of years with several operators, mm-hmm. and what I've noticed with them is they're just another form a pilot fills out, and they're, I literally knew an airline that launched a flight after a plane crashed, but the risk assessment form didn't pop up saying they couldn't go, so they launched another airplane to a super slick runway, and the next guy went out and wouldn't land because he said it was too dangerous, but... So what have you done different with risk assessment forms? I know a lot of you guys had the same idea of risk assessment forms, which is why you didn't do them. But
well, what we were able to do, you know, it's hard to experience or hard to quantify experience and conditions. I mean, Right. Those are very difficult things to put in a box and say this condition is associated with this number for risk. So we've gotten rid of the math portion. I don't know, the traditional risk assessments. You add numbers up and come up with a risk. Well, this one, we've just identified them. We've also put a number that corresponds, or a letter that corresponds with each risk for accountability process, but we've gone through and kind of streamlined it. We know, you know, there's no mystery out there. We know what conditions are risky and we know which ones aren't. We
Right.
just have to identify and discuss them and determine whether or not we're willing to accept that risk under these conditions or not accept that risk. So it really cuts down the legwork. So we've got, you know, four categories, 1, 2, 3, and 4, green, yellow, red, and black. You know, basically green one, or category one is common day-to-day risk, walking up and down the stairs, daylight, you know, no restrictions, no DMIs, nothing that's really identifiable as a risk during the release process. The second one, we go into, you know, nighttime, there's some risk associated with night, there's risk associated with IMC, you know, known icing, winds above 15 knots, any restrictions. So the operation control agent and the pilot discuss that risk and they're able to release it at their level. Now once we get up into the category three of the red risk level, we start into special VFR operations, surface winds above 30 knots, above your demonstrated crosswind, runways less than 1,800 feet. Part 91 flights have a high level risk. It seems to be quite a few accidents during Part 91 operations for commercial carriers, so we've put that in that category. Those require a Part 119 management person's release, or Operation Control Center will contact the designated person on duty that day and discuss that and determine whether or not we're willing to accept that risk at that level.
Okay, and either way, this is the pilot calling the op center and going through this form.
Yes,
and
yes.
Identifying the risk and then having a discussion with the ops agent.
And then concurring on those risks that they
right.
see the same thing. The ops agent sees the same risk as the pilot sees. And there are disputes. You know, Greg can explain that a little bit, how these operation patrol agents will sometimes say, hey, I see something that you're not seeing here. What do you, well, we need to elevate it. Then they take it to the next level and we get involved after that.
And the ops agent can just cancel it. They
yes.
say, I don't like this, which I know a lot of pilots get kind of offended by, but at the same time, it takes a lot of pressure off the pilot if the discussion is and the ops agent says, your weather's just not, I don't like your weather, it's not good enough. I know you've been out there for 10 years, you know what you're doing, but this doesn't seem safe. And the pilot takes the pressure off their shoulders and they go to the station manager and say, hey, sorry,
for a
no-go.
For a risk level 2, 1 or 2, both the pilot and the operations control agent must agree that the flight is good to go. Either one of them can say, no, we're not going to go. To increase the risk, it can be just one person. To lower the risk, it has to be both person that says, you know, we agree that this is where we are. And then, of course, at a higher risk level 3, then you need all three concurring, even the 119 manager, because even if the 119 manager were to say, I don't have a problem with this, one of the operational control agents still has the authority to say, you know, I don't agree, I'm not going to release this flight. And there's no retribution to him. It'll get further analysis. But in order for a level 3 to be released, all three, the 119 manager, the pilot, and the operational control agent, have to agree that it's reasonable to conduct the flight.
Okay. And a lot of this for the ops center, this is like one Part 121 airlines run in a similar fashion.
Well, it is. It's been compared to 121. You know, some of the significant differences in it. Of course, we're releasing 207s, Caravans, 1900s, Navajos. You know, our sister agency, Era Aviation, they have Dash 8s and 1900s. They do 121 dispatchers. Dispatch releases for about 40 flights a day. We're releasing about 145 flights a day. And when I say a flight, it's actually a series of flight, because we release them from the station and then they may go out and do 2 or 3 stops and come back to the station. So the volume of the flights that we're releasing dictate that it's not a traditional 121 analysis that's put into paper and then given to a pilot an hour before the flight. Ours are a bit more real time in that we're discussing it with the pilot within 30 minutes of his departure and continually to monitor the conditions of the flight throughout the entire process, like 121. However, the discussions are very real time and real events that are happening right then. I've had pilots call and say, I'm headed to from Nome to Savunga. My alternate's going to be Unalakleet. And the operation control agent may say, well, did you see the Unalakleet got a braking action of nil? And the pilot has said, no, when did that come out? Well, it came out 20 minutes ago. So very current information and very discussions about, you know, real-time conditions.
As they're and we all know, like Gnome and Kotz and Barrow tend to have fog that'll sit right off the runway, and that could come up, which you can't see that on a weather report.
Correct.
But the pilot might bring up, yeah, we got a wall of fog sitting off the runway. I want to take extra fuel.
Correct.
And you also have you're mentioning 207s. You got planes that are capable of very different things. Unlike the sister company, where they're running Dash 8s and 1900, both, you know, full IFR, no icing, all that kind of stuff. You're running a 207, so you've got to cater to what the aircraft is. And every flight might have a different type. It might be a 207 in the morning and a caravan in the afternoon.
Correct. And it may be a short, you know, 7-minute flight that it's leaving Bethel and going to one of the local villages. So there's an awful lot of things going on with the different type of aircraft.
Okay. But there's also been a more emphasis, and this has been tried in the past too, to go file IFR more. And I saw this when I came back out here. You have GPS approaches everywhere. It's possible to do a whole flight filing IFR for most of these flights. And it seems like there's an interest in actually making that start happening.
A lot of encouragement to go IFR whenever the opportunity is there. There are a few places still in Western Alaska that don't have approaches. Of course, our 207s aren't IFR equipped. The caravans, they are, and there are situations where they might be able to do that, but they don't, it may just be such a short leg that it wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking literally a flight less than 5 minutes from the station. That wouldn't make a lot of sense.
And it could actually be less safe. I mean, if you've got an 800-foot ceiling, you're going into Pasquiak, and you're going to try to file IFR, and you're going to pop up in the clouds and in ice, you're probably better off staying low. So you guys take that, the off people, that's always been a fuss out there. It's like, okay, you want to, when I was at Frontier, they're like, I file IFR everywhere. And it's like, well, that's not always the safest option. So your ops agents are kind of
If we choose to go that way, if we get an abnormal operations report sent to us.
Okay.
So all the Part 119 managers are in the loop as to why we're flying a fully equipped piece of machinery, BFR, to a destination with an IFR approach. You know, it might be, you know, distance,
right?
Icing. We don't want to lower the standard of safety by not operating that equipment because it's IFR and there's icing. But if we can do it safely and get underneath the clouds and do it right, we'll take it.
There's been a lot of talk about the culture of the organization, and you know, I think the culture has been that of any rural Alaskan bush operation, and that everybody's trying to get things done and the best way we can with limited time and limited weather. But as an example of how our culture's changing, we had a perfect example of that today. Jason, the director of ops, has implemented a limitation for our airlines that our special operations are limited to 600 foot and 2 miles. 600 foot ceilings and 2 miles.
Instead of the 502.
Instead of the 502, we're at 602. And, you know, today, so anytime a pilot chooses to do a special VFR departure out of a station, that is automatically a risk level 3. They have to call the operation control agent, connects them to the 119 manager. They discuss exactly why they're doing that. You know, they look at the risks and the weather associated with it, and make a decision on whether or not it's really something we need to do. Well, today, as an example, I noticed these emails from the abnormal ops for special VFRs, and I looked at the first one, and it said that a pilot was requesting a special, and he actually had, I don't know what it was, 3 miles and a ceiling of scattered 900. So I called my operation control agent, and I said, well, scattered 900 is not a ceiling. Why are we asking for special? And he said, well, in an abundance of caution, the pilot just said, you know what, it's the weather's kind of, those ceilings are up and down, and he just wanted to make certain that he didn't end up in special VFR conditions without getting the authorization. And then I looked at the other special VFR requests in those emails, and they were all 700 foot overcast, 900-foot overcasts. So those overcasts, okay. Those scatters were coming and going. And so, again, I think as a culture change, we had a pilot who said, "I'm just going to do the right thing here and make sure I'm covered, rather than just say, oh, I've got scattered, I don't need it," and away he goes.
Right.
And I think that's a significant a significant demonstration of how, you know, things are changing in the company with how we do business.
Well, I'm going to point out, as part of my worries, people thought that there was a problem here at this company, and this was all standard Western Alaska operation for all companies. Mm-hmm. And you guys are kind of moving ahead beyond that at this point. The nice thing about this, you guys didn't listen to my talk with Brian Weckworth in December after the accident in St. Mary's, but I felt it was the older pilots like me who have been out here for a while who were resisting the change, and that was causing some of the problems across statewide, not just here. And this kind of reels them in, and like, I need to watch myself too. I love to get a special that's easier and just makes my life simpler than filing IFR, but that's not necessarily the better option. And this is kind of holding pilots accountable who might want to just take the easy way out, and kind of questioning why they aren't filing IFR.
You know, Greg's talking about our culture change. You know, Western Alaska 5, 6, 7 years ago, 10 years ago. You know, it was a culture of whatever it takes, get it done.
Yep.
You know, do the job, find a way, make it happen. You know, work with what you got, adapt and overcome, make it happen. But you know, our company recently has switched to a culture of compliance and conformity. You know, our goal now is to provide the highest level possible for the general flying highest level safety possible for the general flying public, and by doing that, I think we'll become a better carrier, a stronger carrier. We are the largest carrier in the state right now, so we do have a certain level of social responsibility to lead the way and not follow the herd.
Yep.
So we are trying to lead the direction that will enhance safety statewide, not just for us. And things in Alaska do move slow, but it's picking up. You know, I see we're getting calls from other carriers. We've had other carriers stop by. We've had a lot of government agencies come through here and audit our program, and nobody's walked out of here and said, you know what, this isn't going to work. Everybody's been very pleased.
Despite the press, you showed me yesterday that two letters from government agencies that said this was a very good system, contrary to the press, and you guys are always bad at the press, but contrary to what the press was, the government agencies are actually impressed with what you've been doing.
Well, I think most of the pilots are extremely supportive, and they understand that, you know, what we're doing, just the very size of our organization is so unprecedented that the 135 regulations in many ways weren't meant for a company as big as we are. I mean, when you're talking about 950 releases a week, which actually is about 3,000 flight legs a week,
right.
That type of activity stretched out all over, you know, Alaska in our 10 different stations, the sheer volume of that requires more oversight and you know, perhaps less independence from each station or even each pilot.
Right.
And the majority of them welcome that. There's still some that have some resistance to the fact that they have all this oversight, you know, hundreds of miles away, because historically they're a pretty independent group, used to relying on their own decisions with the help of the station and the local support. But I think, again, you know, we know from 121 that a dispatch center can be anywhere. And with the resources we have today, with satellite and internet and everything else, you can have a pretty good idea of what's going on in a region.
Well, you can watch, on your screens.
Yes.
Every plane, real time, you can see where it is.
We're watching our airplanes. We're looking at all of the various resources we have to help make decisions. But then also we still rely on the pilot out there who's right there and telling us, you know, this is what I'm seeing. And that's a huge part of our risk assessment. And we're constantly putting NOTAMs on our boards in the Operation Control Center as they read. But then right under that NOTAM, we'll have, this is what the NOTAM reads, this is what the pilot's saying.
Right.
So we're always sharing that information and making decisions on whether we're going to conduct the flight or delay a flight or reroute a flight.
And I want to come back to some things Jason said, but I'm going to, since we've gone in this direction for right now, there are two things with that. The relying on the pilot, it used to be the pilot trying to get the flight going. So, like, if they would talk to somebody, they'd be like, well, I think I can make it. I did it yesterday. And now it's more, the pilot's actually going to be the more restrictive thing. Like, if the ops guy, the 119 guy, sees the weather looking really good, if the pilot can come back and say, yeah, but there's some fog rolling in that you can't see.
Right, and one of the things that we don't do anymore is, you know, it used to be that a station manager feeling the pressure of the customers or moving the mail or whatever external pressures he had or she would, you know, we used to have this thing in the station that was real common where, you know, the verbiage would be, why don't you go take a look? You know, right. Well, you know, that's kind of a roll of the dice kind of philosophy. We don't have that anymore. We don't have, why don't you go take a look? What we have is we have decisions based on real data and real information, and we come to a conclusion on whether we're going to delay, proceed, or cancel. And we don't, and sometimes we've even, you know, adjusted routings. We'll say, well, you know, you might be headed from Bethel to Chivac, but there's some weather we are aware of in the middle. You know, if we do this dogleg routing, then we're out of the weather, and we may make those decisions. But we do not anymore say, why don't you just go take a look and see what you find.
And that had changed a while ago, I think. It was out there probably a little bit, but with weather reporting at each station, that was more common when you didn't have weather. And it'd be like, well, we don't really know what the agent says. It looks good. That's always questionable. So go take a look. And the interesting thing is I left and came back, of course, a few times in the 90s. It was definitely much more free-for-all out here. And when I came back, I was actually surprised at how much conservative not just Hagelin was, but most of Western Alaska. So that's why, again, when all this kind of press came down about Renegade operation, I'm like, man, it's definitely been getting safer and more conservative, which was a good thing. And this is like the next step, having to centralize, actually formalizing it, and certainly giving the company a little more control over what's going on. While you guys were in compliance before, this is actually even more control. How much of this was in conjunction with the FAA, and how much of this you guys coming forward and saying, this is what we want to do?
It was approved by the FAA, but this was 100% on our side. I mean, the FAA obviously worked very close with us. Our POI was very helpful and contributed a lot. Nudged us in the right direction, said you're barking up the right tree, or this okay. is not the way you want to go. But everything here was entirely our operations ideas and work. So they were with a little bit of guidance from the FAA on what we needed to do or how we can improve it.
Cool, because you had a task force come out from D.C., actually come up here and look at things.
Yeah, we had
that's how high level the concern was a few months ago.
Yeah, there were some reports that came out in the media that weren't in our favor, and it triggered a response, a big response nationwide. So we had an AFS 900 group come from D.C. We had the Department of Interior come in and audit and review us.
We've had a medallion audit.
Medallion Foundation came up.
Star for our operational control.
Yeah, we received our operational control star based on their audit. The comments from those folks were that it's the most impressive operational control center they'd ever seen. And the guy that stated that has reviewed all the operational control centers around the state and various ones at other locations. The big thing is the response to the media reports that were coming out.
Right.
And what happened after that. It's gratifying when you get a bunch of mudslinging and they come out and actually see the real story and see what's going on and go, hey, you know what, this is way above and beyond what we expected.
It's not a renegade outfit.
It is not renegade by far.
We had our events and the tragic, loss of life in December, and the company was immediately taking action to recognize how can we do things to lessen the likelihood of that type of incident. It seems like some of the federal agencies got on board the wagon well after we already had things in place. In fact, this Operation Control Center started in January. It didn't start working independently with full approval from the FAA until early February. however, and I don't remember when that NTSB media event came out, but it was after we were already in motion, after a lot of things. We'd already had audits done. You know, right. ERA had already had an audit. We were in the process of an external audit. So a lot of the things were well underway, recognized by the company before some of the reports came out.
How has this, because I know me again, late 90s would have claimed that none of this would work and the company would just go bankrupt. How has this actually affected having this operational control center, affected actual operations in the bush?
Well, last month, May, we had a record month for operations. So we flew more flights in the month of May than we've flown ever in the month of May. We were more profitable because a lot of it, you know, in the past we've left the operational control process of the company to the individual stations, which wasn't necessarily the best idea because you'd have people that would take a flight with one person and make repeated attempts to get into a village or an airport with marginal weather. Well, now with our
I'm just going to point out that you can. I mean that was compliance. I mean you can delegate station managers to be in charge of dispatching flights.
So yeah, we were within the regulations.
Yeah,
at that
it was
point.
Definitely not a renegade operator.
But you touch on a very good point because the challenge for us was how to have the statewide operational control and not bog down a 207 operation in Bethel where your flights are 7-minute flights, some of them.
Right.
Everything is happening very fast. Everything is changing. You know, if you try to do a traditional 121 dispatch release in Bethel 207 operation, by the time they got the paper that was their dispatch release, they would have changed their plans and said, well, okay, some fog rolled in, we'll go in this direction instead. So the challenge was how to be so dynamic that we could not bog down our company and stay successful in the operations. And, you know, I had some 121 dispatch experience, and one of the things that we did right was instead of putting the program on paper and on what we thought would work and then implementing that, we kind of, with Jason's leadership, we threw people into it and said, let's get something rolling. And then we found out what was actually working and what wasn't going to work. And then we wrote our manuals based on what we succeeded in. So we were building this from the ground up, but by what would work for us. And so by having a 2-minute conversation with some pilots, sometimes as many as 5 minutes, but often it's only a 2-minute conversation that goes, you know, this is what the intent is. We've already looked and know we have an airworthy airplane. We know we have an airworthy pilot. We're looking at weather. When the pilot calls, we're going to look more specifically at his weather and NOTAMs, discuss the risks that he's come up with, discuss any risk concerns we have. And we can do all that routinely within 2 minutes, and away he goes.
Well, and what I like with that ops center, because I've worked with other companies that had something like that, you call in, but your guys here have all the information. The approach plates was actually cool, mm-hmm. because when you're filing for a flight, your approach plates are probably in your airplane, and you don't know what the minimums are off the top of your head to Hoover right. Bay, whereas they can pull it up and say, hey, you're filing IFR, well, you know, you're 100 feet over minimums, so you're going to need an alternate. And instead of me figuring all that, I can call one guy who's going to help me.
Yeah, crosswinds is another big one that 4Flight does for us. You know, you just touch one touch on your iPad, and through 4Flight, you have all that information. Approach plates, you can do, okay, this is what the winds are, this is what the crosswinds are. So you can, it really enables us to get a great deal of information right now so that we can get a conversation with the pilot and make a good decision and have them on their way.
It also gives you more effort in case something does go wrong. You can talk to the ops guy and say, okay, you ops this flight. What were you guys discussing? Right. And then you instantly know you've got a picture of what developed around that flight.
And as soon as we've released them, we're still looking. We're still right. looking for changes in NOTAMs. We're still looking for information that might affect the flight. And then it's just it's easy to recontact and say, well, wait a minute, we've just learned this. We may need to delay the flight. We may need to turn the flight around.
Right. And as Jason was saying before I interrupt him there, your operations seem to be running fairly smoothly.
I think we're running more efficiently and we're running more profitably because we are controlling, you know, risk versus reward. Are we willing to accept this level of risk for this reward?
Right.
So, and it is expensive to go out and take a look when you don't when it doesn't result in any revenue moved.
Yeah.
You know,
and this
we've stopped a lot of flights.
Well, and that's interesting because you've actually taken the profit out of the decision making process.
We
it's
have.
Actually made it more profitable by doing that, or at least
we're making logical. You know, we're using logic to release flights instead of emotion. You know, in the past, it's been an emotionally driven.
We need to get that mail.
We need to get these people out. We need to get the mail out. The postal inspector is going to transfer it. You know, if somebody's grandmother's about to pass away, we got to get in there right away. We got to land. You know, we've got medicine on board for these people.
Yep.
My paycheck's on board.
Yeah,
things like that. So there's a lot of emotional reasons to accept risk, and we've eliminated that here with this operation control center. Because these guys are just basing their decision on what they can prove, what they can see, and if you know, a lot of times what they can't see stops the flight too. If we don't have information, we're not gonna go. We're not gonna go take a look.
Right.
That becomes expensive in a lot of ways. You know, first the fuel you burn. You know, in the past I've seen us and other carriers go out multiple times with minimal revenue on board, making multiple attempts to get into an area.
Yep.
And every attempt you make, the more risky it gets.
Yes.
The more you want to get it.
So yeah, that's it. The pilot gets more.
I saw it last time. You know, I saw two runway lights last time. So if I go around one more time, I know what I'm looking at now. I know what the ground looks like. I'll make another attempt. You know, it's totally forbidden these days. I mean, ever. It's just ultra risky, and we're not going to accept that. Now, you know, if we don't know what's going on out there, we're going to find out what's going on out there. We have the resources to do it, and we have the people who can interpret what they hear once they get that information.
Yeah.
So I think we're... You know, we're light years ahead of what we were, you know, even a year ago. So it's
How are the people at the stations reacting? How are the pilots? I mean, are they receptive to this? Are they You said there's some a little resistant. I know 10 years ago I would have resisted. Now I wouldn't, but 10 years ago I would have.
Well, at first we had a lot of resistance to change. People don't like to change. You know,
right.
That takes effort and time. But you know, the dinosaurs went extinct because of change. So. And the only way not to go extinct is to keep changing and evolving. So, you know, evolution is tough. It's not easy. We had a lot of guys that did resist, but now it's gone the other way. We have, you know, people feel like they're part of a team now because we are. This pulls us together. You know, this is our locker room. This is where we huddle and discuss what's going on, what the next play is. So the guys out west, you know, they truly feel like there's a two-tier release system. They feel like they have somebody else backing them up now. The company's 100% behind them when they release the flight. We're saying, we're accepting this. We've got your back on this flight. You know, you're doing everything right. Where in the past, you had a person that would go, well, I want you to go look at them. Well, whose ticket's on the line? You know,
right. There's
a company certificate's not on the line because you're kind of on your own. It's the pilot that's on the line. But now we have accountability building. We have a two-tier system. And the company's on the line as much as the pilot's on the line.
When it gives the pilot a lot of cover, if they get a report from someone on the ground they're flying in weather that was bad. And that's or you get a flat tire and slide off the runway, and these are the kind of things that the last things I'd look at, like, well, the weather's marginal. Okay, nobody's really paying attention, but if I slide off the runway with a flat tire suddenly, but now they can say, hey, listen, this was a discussion, this is what you've got a record of what the weather was.
And I think that our program has received some credibility, which has come a long way to get acceptance by some of the pilots. You know, the operations control agents on a number of occasions have provided pilots with information they did not already have. And then when I worked in the 121 dispatch, you had a management level approval, but that person in the management level didn't necessarily have to be a pilot or anyone that really knew the geographical areas. And our program, our 119 managers have all flown out in Western Alaska. So when the call goes to the 119 manager, he can have a discussion with the pilot,
a meaningful
discussion about, you know, I've listened to Jason and say, well, this is what you're going to encounter and this is what you're going to see. And, you know, he's talking about the terrain out there and talking about the conditions and talking about things that the pilots are truly dealing with. And that gives them a tremendous amount of credibility because
they've
been out there and they've done it. So I think the more we've done that, the more buy-in we've received from the pilots that, okay, this has some value. And I've said to everyone that I've talked to about this, at the very least, our program gets a pilot to think and talk about the flight. You know, they've got a lot of things going on. They're fueling airplanes. They're doing other things. They're dealing with some customers. This ensures that they're going to stop and give their flight some real thought, because they got to tell somebody about it. It forces them to, at the very least, they got to talk about their flight. This is the risk assessment I've arrived at. This is what I'm doing. And so there's that built-in pause to concentrate on your flight.
Yeah.
That's the very least that we do. The very best that we do is we provide that pilot with some information significant to his flight that he didn't already have.
And with one phone call. They're not calling up the National Weather Service. They're not going online to check whether they make one phone call and get all of it. And you touched on something that we talked about yesterday, and that's something that can't be regulated, and it's very hard to control, is the feeling of being rushed. And it's not just this airline. It's every airline I've been to, except a very few.
You know,
pilots are relaxed.
Yeah, and I would say that part of the nature of 135 operations is that oftentimes people are operating with a sense of urgency.
Right.
You see that. You see them, and that's driven by many, many factors. It may be driven by the weather, or you're out there with the people. You're on the ground with the customers. You don't see 121 pilots appearing to be operating with a sense of urgency about getting things accomplished.
Right. They could honestly care less whether they're on time for the next flight.
Correct.
That's not their concern.
And so there is the nature of rural Alaska tends to put this sense of urgency in our flight crews. And so that's another culture shift that the company's working towards, is to try to, stay efficient and yet not have flight crews feeling this sense of urgency that could lead them to not consider things that they need to be thinking about.
And that's, and as I said yesterday, I'm just guilty. I love rushing around and zooming and trying to get stuff done, but I find that's when I forget stuff. And I was telling you yesterday, I've watched Jim Tweedo work for years, and he owns this company. If anyone should feel urgency, it's Jim Tweedo. And you watch him get a plane ready, and he's always going at a very steady pace. He'll always stop to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And he gets everything done on time, but it's funny that the owner kind of has this innate sense of kind of being relaxed about the flight that pilots at most companies don't quite have. I've always been impressed about that by Jim. How crazy is he's always kind of, I've walking off at 7:30 in the morning when he's talking on the phone to five people, but he's always kind of calm and relaxed. And I think all of us as pilots should try to maybe slow down a little bit and get those flights going as we can.
Yeah, you move with a purpose.
Yeah.
Just
nice, slow, and steady. We should all have a beer in the morning.
Well, who says we don't?
Yeah, no, just kidding.
Just kidding, we don't.
Obviously.
Yeah.
That was the days, old good old days in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think any other big changes that you guys have made that you think of? That's
risk assessment forms, operational control. Big culture change, we've implemented certain meetings that we do, each shift meetings, briefing, just to get guys interacting with each other, pulling a group together and start talking about issues and problems, concerns we have statewide. That's new in our system. Before,
okay.
Again, it was just, 11 individual bases operating on their own. Now we're able to call all those guys in together, review what's happened in the past. We've also put in place a couple different manual change procedures. All of our GOMs come out.
I like that.
Color-coded GOMs.
Yeah,
so
then you send in one and you get the next one.
The next one, yeah, instead of getting a bunch of revisions and relying on the guy, the lowest common denominator, the guy who doesn't know how to update a revision, we update them for him and keep them all accurate.
No one knows how to update revisions.
Yeah.
And I know we've got several of our members who are flying for you guys now, and they're sort of your newer pilots, and I've talked to them recently. Most of them are really happy with these changes.
Yeah.
They like the way it's going. It's sort of it's a little more in line with lower 48 stuff. And do you feel like the state's headed this way? I mean, my feeling is the state's headed this way, so that's kind of a leading question. But 10 years from now, you'll see most companies operating in this manner.
What we've seen, talking to other carriers around the state, we're trying to lead the parade here.
Yep.
Yeah, we do have a big responsibility being the largest carrier in the state. We want to make sure that we provide the best, safest service that we can. And I think that other carriers are starting to recognize that. We get a lot of calls, a lot of questions. You know, every day there's somebody new calling, going, "Hey, what are you guys doing out? You know, what's this big mystery in Palmer?" So
it's the Skunk Works.
Yeah, yeah, we're kind of like the CIA out here. It's, you know, a discreet building back in a corner.
This your Anchorage office is fine, but I like this. This is quiet. Mm-hmm. It feels more Alaskan, honestly. You've got mountains out the window.
Got the glacier.
Yeah, you've got the glacier.
The best view.
You've got DC-3s and DC-4s sitting around, and C-119s or C-82s. This is just a question I had. You're not going to know the answer to this. Because Alaska operates under a bunch of exemptions, 135 exemptions. Mm-hmm. And having just done the Kenmore Air Ground School, and I realized they don't operate their lower 48. Do you see a time in the future when the feds might start pulling those exemptions back? They're mainly flight and duty exemptions.
It's hard to tell. You know, obviously we can't answer. We don't know what they've got.
Yeah, that'll be a ways down the road, too.
On their agenda. But it's so unique up here with the daylight, the distances, and the seasons. You know, we fly a lot of flights during different periods of time, and other times we slow down. So I think I don't see any change coming soon.
Okay.
So that's
cool. But it does seem like the rest of this is, and with the instrument approaches, it is more in line with lower 48 operations. Yeah. I was just curious if you'd heard. That's actually, it's always good to have exemptions and keep them if you can.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they are flight duty issues, which really hasn't been the issue over the last few years. So how'd you like your new position as DO?
I'm enjoying it. It's challenging. You know, there's never a dull moment, but I do enjoy it.
Yeah.
Now, I do miss working with the pilots directly every day. You know, now we kind of work with the upper management, the FAA, more than the pilot.
At least we had, you know, breakfast with Snuggies this morning.
Yeah, we had breakfast with the guys. I enjoyed that. And, you know, I wish we could get out in the field more. That's the only regret I have about being in here. I like being out in the bush with the guys. But I hang out with Greg every day, so that makes up for everything.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. I think I've covered everything I want to cover. Just for kind of for our members out there, do you see any hiring in the future? Are you pretty well set for a while?
I see a lot of hiring in the future. You know, we're continuing to buy more airplanes. The industry's changing. The airlines are sucking a lot of pilots out of our pool.
Yep.
Sister company,
sucking them out.
Sister company takes them. We can, we're still able to hire pilots with a fresh commercial
for the right seat program.
For the right seat programs we have in place, which is a great program. You know, it allows guys to go from a fresh commercial, 250-hour commercial license to 1,500 hours to meet the minimum requirements for a 121 operation. Yeah. I don't know how guys are going to do that in this day and age with all the restrictions in place. It's getting tougher.
Yeah,
a lot tougher. Is. So. But yeah, we're going to be hiring.
Cool.
Or we currently are hiring.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I'll put the word out there, too.
Yep.
Cool. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well.
Cool. So, I like I said at the beginning of this, I just wanted to clear up some of the confusion as to what might be going on here at Haglin/Raven. You have changed your name. You're now officially Raven
Connect. Well, we're Haglin Aviation Services. We do business as Raven Connect.
Okay, so checks are still coming to people from Haglin Aviation.
Oh, that's the certificate.
Yep. And Raven stand, what's that stand for? Rural Alaska Village Network? That's not official. That's
plus the Raven.
We can't spell, you know, R-A-V-N.
And plus the Raven is the quintessential bird of Alaska.
Yeah, yeah. It so we see a lot of company traffic when we're flying around out there.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, well, I'm going to wrap this up, and we'll go back to our work days. So this is Aiden with Oddball Pilot with Jason Wilson and Greg Tanner. Over and out.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.